Good morning. Go ahead and be seated, and we'll start with our last case on calendar today. And that would be docket number 63176, Luna v. District Court. Ms. Grigsby, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right. Come on up.
Good morning. I'm Abara Grigsby. I represent Jennifer Luna, the petitioner. Before I begin, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents a number of interesting and important issues, primarily of which is, can a parent abuse or neglect a child when there is a guardianship in place? In this case, when the subject minor was removed from the home, the subject minor was the ward of a guardian pursuant to Chapter 159 of NRS. The guardianship continued uninterrupted until the ward turned 18. Judge Sullivan ruled that a natural mother had an obligation to support the ward while the guardianship was in place. He based that ruling on NRS 159.079, subsection 7. He made an error in ruling that the mom had an obligation to support this child when there was a guardianship in place. The guardianship statute provides that the guardian has an obligation to supply the ward with food, shelter, clothing, shelter, and all incidental necessaries, including located and appropriate residence for the ward.
Counsel, in the first section that you talked about under, I guess it's 159, sub 7, doesn't it still obligate the parent to be responsible?
It does. The subsection specifically says that the section does not relieve a parent or other person of any duty required by law to provide for the care, support, and maintenance of any dependent. I believe that subsection relates directly to any child support orders that are in place.
And where do you find that authority that would relate to the child support type orders?
Based on the plain language of the statute, it states that for the care, support, and maintenance of any dependent, which is pursuant to law, so a child support order would...
Is there any case authority out there? Because quite candidly, I may not be the best researcher, but I looked this morning to better try to understand that sub 7 in this particular case. Because in essence, and we have an older case, basically obligating the parent to still be secondarily, so to speak, reliable. We have an odd situation here that no one is accusing the mother of abusing the child. The neglect is what is at issue because of the circumstance of mother trying to do the right thing, putting her under a guardian, the guardian, so to speak, abandoning that ward, even though she tried to place her with another guardian. And we won't, that's not the purpose of this, what they didn't do, but that was never properly done. But we have someone alleging to the department that this person underage was being placed at risk, so the department took charge of her and conducted this hearing. And as you said, we're back to this crossroads statute, is the parent relieved because they've substituted someone in, or can the parent be held responsible for their choice? And we were talking a little bit, or thinking about it in terms of other situations where you have a parent quite often for educational purposes saying that I live in a community, education's not good, I'm going to send my child out to live with Uncle Bill or Aunt Susie because the school system's better. But then what happens if Uncle Bill or Aunt Sally gets in an accident and is in a coal mine, something happens with the kid? So kind of, who is ultimately responsible? Do we alleviate this? And we have a statute that says, no, the parent is still responsible. And I guess I was searching and hoping you had some law from some other jurisdictions that address that issue.
I wasn't able to find anything in our jurisdiction. When I did my research, I wasn't able to see anything similar from other states. But what we have from our state in Fisher v. Fisher, this court found that the guardian has the duty to provide for the ward. And I believe this case is quite different in that the child was removed from, not from the guardian, from a third party, but when CPS did their investigation, at their conclusion, they found that there was no abuse and neglect by that third person.
Well, they failed to conduct as of that third person. There were allegations made by parties, there were statements, but you're correct in terms of there was no finding made.
The district attorney didn't even file a petition against the person that the child was removed from. They initially filed it against the guardian and the natural mother. Then they dismissed against the guardian, letting the court know that they don't believe that the guardian did anything that amounted to abuse or neglect of the child. But I think that's where the error was. The investigator testified that the department never even looked at placing the subject minor with the guardian. So at that point, I don't think the state can go after the mother when they said the guardian didn't do anything wrong, the person that they removed from didn't do anything wrong.
Counsel, if I understand your position correctly, I guess the long and short of it is that you would say that the then minor should be returned to the mother? Because that's kind of where we were. We have one person who says, I don't want to be guardian anymore. They've given the kid to somebody else. That person says, I'm voluntarily going to say, I don't want this kid either. So we have a child who's at the time under 18. So the question is, where should the child go?
Well, the Department of Family Services actually placed the child in a homeless shelter. And if DFS wasn't involved, the child could have still gone to a homeless shelter for the 2 days that she was a ward of the juvenile court. Because she was made a ward of the juvenile court 2 days before she turned 18. So during that time, the Department of Family Services had placed her in a homeless shelter. And that was the testimony at the time of trial. So if we're saying that we're protecting the child from neglect of the mother, then I would assume that the department would place her in a placement they found appropriate, and it was the homeless shelter run by Westcare that they found to be the inappropriate placement.
During the pendency of this action, if my understanding is correct, the department at best had, it was a very temporary situation without some hearing to give them authority to do anything.
They always, when they took the child into protective custody, they can make any placement that they deem appropriate at that time since they have protective custody over the child. So based on the guardians, and Judge Sullivan found that once the guardian can't provide, then mom's rights come in. But Chapter 159 is very specific about what needs to be done to terminate a guardianship, to dissolve a guardianship, for a guardian to resign from being a guardian. So at the time the child came in, there was a guardianship in place, and that guardian was never explored for placement. The testimony at trial was that the guardian resides out of state, and that's why that wasn't an option for the department. But from the testimony, it was clear that the guardian had never even been explored. So it's not that the guardian couldn't provide for the child, because that was...
Well, so you said it hadn't been explored. My understanding of the record, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and if not, show me, give me a record cite. Testimony, at least what was derived, was that that party had was no longer wished to be guardian, original guardian of record.
The guardian, it was actually never even explored. So there wasn't any direct testimony that the guardian didn't want to be the guardian anymore. The only testimony was that at some point the guardian allowed her to go live with that third party where the child was removed from, but there was never any testimony or finding by the court that the guardian did not wish to be a guardian anymore.
I thought the guardian, my impression, at least reading through all this material, was the guardian just took off and moved to California or moved out of state and just left it with somebody else.
And when she was actually summoned for the trial, she showed up, and whatever conversation she had with the district attorney dismissed the petition against the guardian, stating that the guardian hadn't done anything that amounted to abuse or neglect of the subject minor. And I'm not sure what that was based on. There weren't any findings made by the court. The other issue that I wanted to address was the court hearing and deciding on an unfiled motion. The unfiled motion filed by the subject minor. The motion was never filed, still hasn't been filed. I'm not sure why it was never filed, but the hearing master put it on her calendar through a MARD, a notice and approval to reset or reschedule a court date, which isn't a procedure allowed by our law. And she signed that MARD slip knowing that she was subject to a motion to disqualify. I was emailed a copy of the motion the day before it was set to be heard. I objected to the motion being heard, but the hearing master continued it for me to file a written response to the unfiled motion. Even if, and it should have, procedurally it should have been denied, but even on the merits it should have been denied. It was a motion for telephonic testimony. The only thing that the child cited to was financial hardship for the witness to come testify in the proceedings. The case on point is Berry v. Linder, where this court decided that there has to be special circumstances to allow telephonic testimony. In this case, there weren't any special circumstances. The grounds that the Judge Sullivan confirmed the hearing master findings on were that this was essential to prove the district attorney's petition. That's not a valid, that's not a special circumstance to allow telephonic testimony, that it can't be, that it's essential to one party's case.
In your view, what is required?
Don't find something more than mere financial hardship or the, and this was a witness that wasn't subpoenaed, that wasn't, there was no disclosure of this witness until 3 days before the third trial setting. So this was an unnoticed witness that was noticed 3 days before the third trial setting. Then the motion that was brought up and they were filed for this testimony, due process requires a proper notice and an opportunity to be heard. There was never any proper notice of this witness. And the grounds that were found for her to be able to testify just don't meet the special circumstance exception. What a hearing master found was that there was no other way to obtain this evidence. There was no evidence before the court to make that finding on. State didn't represent or the subject minor didn't present any evidence that they tried alternative ways to obtain this evidence. The hearing master found that the testimony would not be in dispute, but it was in dispute, and that travel would be very difficult for the witness, and that was based on pure speculation. There was nothing presented to the hearing master where she could make that ruling. And I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Yes, we had a question. Will you two be dividing your time at all? And if so, how are you going to allocate that?
Yes, Your Honor, we would be dividing the time. I would reserve 8 minutes for myself and 7 minutes for Ms. Armaney.
Okay, very good.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Jenny Coleman. I'm a Chief Deputy District Attorney representing the Department of Family Services and the people of Clark County. The central issue in this case is whether or not a parent can be found responsible for the abuse or neglect of a child when there's a valid 159 guardianship in place. The Department submits to this Court that the answer is yes. Specifically, the controlling statute is NRS 159.057, subsection 7, which specifically and expressly provides that a parent is not relieved of any duty, legal duty, to provide for the care, support, or maintenance of any dependent. And that's what's at issue here in this case. There was a valid guardianship in place. It started with Evelyn, which was her stepmother. After her father passed away, legal guardianship was consented to by the biological mother, Jennifer, and she resided with her for some time. When Evelyn decided to leave Nevada and the child did not want to go with, the guardianship was transferred to Marjorie Friedman, and it was done legally and filed with the court. At some point in time, Marjorie was moving out of state as well. Again, Rebecca wished to remain in Las Vegas, and so she transferred the guardianship to a third person. And the problem was, and what I learned at the December 20th hearing, when Ms. Friedman first was located and appeared on the summons when I had located her through diligence search, was that she had filled out all of the paperwork she had presented to the court. It was notarized, it was complete in its entirety, but she failed to file it with the paperwork. She was not aware that she was still legally responsible for Rebecca. So when the child came into the care of the Department of Family Services, she was removed from the third guardian, who technically had no legal responsibility to her because the paperwork had not been filed. Rebecca did not want to return to the home of the third home in which she came into our custody, and I apologize, I don't recall her name. The bottom line, Your Honors, is in her briefing, Mother relies upon Chapman v. Chapman. And specifically in Chapman v. Chapman, this court had referenced a California appellate case in which that case had indicated that neglect must occur when a child is in the custody of the parent. This court's holding in Chapman did not specifically make its findings in reversing the termination of parental rights based on Chapman. Rather, this court referenced it and found that there was not substantial evidence in that case to find neglect. The bottom line is not all neglect occurs in the custody of a parent. There's numerous examples of where a non-custodial parent can be neglectful of the child, such as in the circumstance of failure to protect a child from physical or sexual abuse when the non-custodial parent knows that that abuse is occurring in the custodial home. Abandonment can occur. Incarceration, if a child comes into protective custody due to the abuse of the custodial parent and the non-custodial parent is incarcerated, that parent could be subject to neglect findings in that they're unable to provide care for the child due to their incarceration. In any of those situations, a child is not necessarily in the custody of the child, but can still be held responsible for neglect of that child. Additionally, the mother asserts that she's legally prohibited from taking physical custody of the child because of the guardianship still being in place. But in practice, that's not realistic. It takes time for a guardianship to be set aside. And it could take anywhere for 2 to 3 months, depending on how long it takes to locate and notify people. And in this case, when Rebecca came into protective custody in October, it took us almost 2 months to locate the guardian through diligent searching. When a child comes into protective custody, she needs care now. She needs clothing and food and shelter. She needs it now. She doesn't need it 2 months from now when we can get the guardianship set aside. And that's why it is so imperative that when a guardian is no longer able or willing to provide care for a child, that the parental responsibilities fall back to the parent to step up and take care for that child.
Now, in that regard, let me ask you this question. The mother, as I understand it, has been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, and she's been civilly committed. Realistically, going back and addressing the parent and the parent's capability to make good on any type of obligation whatsoever, how does that work? How realistic is that?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding your question, Justice.
How's the mother, from what I understand you just said, when the guardian can't be found, then it falls back on the parent to provide, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and if you have a parent who's unable to provide because of what's been diagnosed as a schizoaffective disorder and that mother has been civilly committed, what are you chasing after? I mean, what are you going to recover?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by recover, but realistically...
How is that parent going to provide?
Well, and she can't. And that's why the petition was filed against her. If let's say, for example, the mother didn't have any mental health problems.
Right.
But she was under guardianship for some reason, and the child comes into protective custody, we immediately always go back to look at the biological parents. And if that biological parent is able to provide care, what we will do, and we would have done in this case, is immediately release that child to that parent because we don't want to trample on a parent's right to parent their child. It's a constitutionally protected right. And if we have no ongoing concerns of abuse or neglect as to that parent, regardless of whether there's a guardianship in place, we would be releasing that child to that parent.
Okay.
And that's why it's the department's position that it doesn't need to be set aside in order for that child to return to that parent. As long as that biological parent is safe and appropriate and able to provide care, we would release the child to them. But that wasn't the situation here, and that's what necessitated my decision to file a petition against her.
Mm-hmm.
And if you review the record, you'll see that I originally filed an allegation against the second guardian, Ms. Friedman, and when her whereabouts were unknown for almost a period of 2 months before we were able to locate her. And when she came forward and presented me with the paperwork showing that she did everything she needed to do except for file that paperwork, I did not think it was a prudent use of our office's resources, or was it necessary to put an abuse or neglect finding on the guardian for merely failing to file paperwork with
Got
the
it.
Court. And that's why I chose to dismiss her from the petition. But nevertheless, because this court's holding recent holding in INRI parental rights as to AG, which precludes the department from providing a case plan to a parent without an absent and underlying abuse or neglect finding, I chose to move forward with the mother to be able to obtain wardship because I felt that that was the most just cause. The bottom line is the underlying reason that guardianship existed in the first place, the entire root of the problem in this case, an issue, was the mother's mental health status.
Counsel, it was stated by Ms. Grigsby that 159.079 subset 7 is clear on its face that it doesn't apply, for the record, the position of the department.
That 157.077 does not
it
apply?
It goes not to relieve the parent or other person of any duty required?
I adamantly disagree. I think the plain language of the statute on its face is very clear that nothing in 159.057 relieves a parent of their duty or obligation to provide care, support, or maintenance. And that includes shelter, housing, clothing, and so forth when the guardian is no longer able to do so. And if I may, Your Honor, I'm already over into Ms. Armini's
All right.
Time.
And Ms. Armini, I'm going to add a minute to your time. And Ms. Grigsby, I'll add a minute to your time as well on your rebuttal.
May it please the Court, my name is Paola Armini, and through my law firm of Gordon Silver in conjunction with Legal Aid of Southern Nevada, I represent the minor child, Rebecca Luna. Your Honors, I would submit to the Court that that mother has not met her burden at an extraordinary relief is warranted in this case. The court did not abuse its discretion and certainly did not abuse its discretion in an arbitrary or capricious way as a writ of mandamus requires. The findings were not clearly erroneous and there was substantial evidence to support the finding. And I'll start with, I know Ms. Grigsby touched on the due process rights and whether or not those were violated. There were procedural issues that occurred in this case. I don't think any of us dispute that. However, at the end of the day, the issue is, for due process, is notice and opportunity to be heard. And that's what we need to look at to see. And that's what Judge Sullivan looked at. And when he looked at that, what was clear is, what is notice? Notice is, was it reasonably conveyed to the person what was going on, the information? Well, what we have here is we have a notice of witnesses that was filed and was served on Ms. Grigsby, or her mother. We had a notice of intent to provide testimony through audiovisual or audio telephonic conference. That was filed and was served on Ms. Grigsby. And then we have this unfiled motion. So what we have is we had knowledge that Ms. Flores, who was the caseworker in Wisconsin, was going to be a witness. She was on the notice of witnesses. We filed a notice to let her know that we wanted to provide that testimony via telephonic testimony. And third, the motion outlined what exactly Ms. Flores was going to say. So Natural Mother had notice in this case of what the issues were and what they were going to be. And then we talk about opportunity to be heard, the second prong of due process. Was there reasonable time for her to respond to this issue of the telephonic testimony of Ms. Flores? Yes. In fact, when we appeared in front of Hearing Master Femiano, she was given a week to file a response, and then we came back in a week and we had oral argument on the issue. So she was heard, the natural mom had the opportunity to file an opposition, which was done, as well as respond orally when we had a hearing on the matter as to her position. So I'd submit to the court that when notice and opportunity are both met, the constitutional requirements are met, and we don't have a due process violation. Now, there was also discussion about the special circumstances. As this court ruled in Berry versus Linder, it's within the court's discretion whether or not they would allow a witness to testify telephonically. And in doing that, the court wanted special circumstances. Now, Berry versus Linder gives some examples in the footnote about what would maybe be a special circumstance, whether it's an exigency, or whether there's consent and knowledge of what the witness is going to say. And in those footnotes, in the case of Berry and Linder, they give examples of where a witness comes in testifies telephonically, but there's a report that is submitted and opposing counsel has that report to review, so they're able to cross-examine them. Our case goes even one step further. Ms. Flores was Jennifer Luna's natural mom's caseworker. They had more access to her than any other party had. And in fact, the record indicates that natural mom's attorney spoke to Ms. Flores before the hearing, and that's in the appendix 325. So, and at that, during that conversation, caseworker was told, rescinded their caseworker was told, you're going to rescind talking to any of the other attorneys, you're not allowed to do that. So at that point, natural mom had more opportunity to speak to this witness, went one step further and knew exactly what could have been going on before. So there is no unfair surprise here. That's what it's about, is there unfair surprise? Was she somehow disadvantaged? Mom knew exactly what the caseworker had, the information that she had, and I think there was a comment that it was never, testimony was in dispute. It wasn't in dispute. The argument through at closing and the argument through the whole hearing was jurisdictional. We shouldn't even be here in the first place because mom doesn't belong in this petition. There was never evidence disputing, contradicting that mom had mental health incapacity and could not take care of this child. That was never disputed. And those are the facts that the court had before it. So they had a situation where a release that was prior given to for myself to speak to the caseworker was rescinded. We discussed concern about credibility, and Femiano, that weighed very heavily on Hearing Master Femiano because she obviously wanted to see the witness in person and that was her preference. But in this situation, caseworker explained that when she testified, she has mental health patients and it's difficult for her to travel. And so that was one thing that was taken into consideration. It was also taken into consideration with these cases. They move quickly. And we didn't have opportunity to get evidence any other way. So this was the best way for us to get evidence. And I think most importantly, the fact that Natural Mom had access to this witness, knew what the person was going to say. It was not an unfair surprise. So with all that, Your Honor, I would submit to you that
there was no abuse of discretion as it relates to the due process claim. And just in regard to, just to follow up to what Ms. Coleman said, and I believe Ms. Grisby had cited the case of Fisher versus Fisher, that's a termination of parental rights case where the standard is higher, it's not preponderance of evidence, it's clear and convincing. And even in that case, they said the welfare of the child is superior to what the parent wants. And that's also, in other words, in Chapman versus Chapman, again, that case also similarly says the dominant purpose is servicing the best interest of the child. And in this instance, I would submit to this court that Rebecca was in need of protection. She had been bounced around, and at the time that she found herself in DFS's custody, nobody wanted her. She didn't have anywhere to go. And mom was the first call. And mom and the caseworker made a decision, or at least through the caseworker, that she couldn't handle Rebecca. And so for that, she needed protection. And that's why this petition had to go forward, so that she could get the protection she needed and be afforded all those rights. And, Your Honor, with that, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to make 2 points regarding the NRS 159.057 subsection 7. I believe it would lead to absurd results if both the guardian and the parent were required to provide the ward with housing, shelter, food, because that's once the guardianship is established, that's the responsibility of the guardian. The second thing I wanted to touch on was the due process argument. The rules are designed to protect the individual from intervention from the state. When the state is interfering in such a personal part of an individual, we need to follow all the rules, make sure that they're abided by in order to show that there isn't any prejudice, unfair prejudice to the individual. In this case, there was unfair prejudice to the mother because the court was hearing unfiled motions. The court was in allowing the testimony by the caseworker, the court was allowing her to divulge confidential information that she wasn't authorized to divulge. There was no court order for her to testify. She wasn't subpoenaed to testify. State argues that she's a mandatory reporter, but when you look at NRS 432B.220, it describes who mandatory reporters are, and they're, for social workers, they're licensed through NRS Chapter 641B and practice in Nevada. In this case, this was a social worker from Wisconsin, has no connection with Nevada. She had no obligation to testify. She was testifying voluntarily. She wasn't a mandatory reporter in this case. And Judge Sullivan found that privileges do not apply in 432B proceedings, which was another violation of Ms. Luna's due process rights because there wasn't anything to indicate that this was a mandatory reporter who had the authorization or was under a court order to testify in these proceedings.
All right, counsel, thank you very much. None of these are easy issues, and that's why you're here today. And so we appreciate very much having you here and your excellent presentation. So this matter will stand submitted.